Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Tyler Wanger, and I want to thank you all for joining us today for today's webinar, Modern Trust Laws. Are irrevocable trusts really irrevocable? Today's speaker is Bridgeford Trust Company President, CEO, and co-founder David Warren, and we are thrilled to have David join us today as he has years of experience in the trust administration and estate planning process. Dave is an attorney, and he has over 15 years of professional experience practicing law and working in the financial services industry. And he served both the trust and wealth management needs of high and ultra-high net worth families across the nation. So, David, thank you again for joining us. And without further ado, I'll turn it over to Dave for today's webinar.
Thank you, Tyler. It's always great to be here with you. And appreciate the opportunity to talk about some pretty exciting topics today, and actually great to see so many friends from around the country and the world part of the webinar today. A lot of these conversations that we've had with people around the country and around the world are exciting because there's been so many changes in the trust industry in the last 15 or 20 years that really has challenged traditional notions of how we look at estate planning, how we look at planning with trusts, how it's impacted the relevancy of trust planning really not only in the United States but increasingly around the world as we see more and more people want to be in the United States and to have their trust in the United States. And really, this quote is going to be a big guiding principle for us for the next couple of minutes. And I came across this quote when we were getting ready to launch Bridgeford. And it says, legal experts contend that there have been more changes in trust law in the last 20 years than have taken place in the prior two centuries. These changes promise to affect every aspect of how trusts are administered for years to come. That was an article in Trust and Estates magazine back in 2012 when we were getting ready to launch Bridgeford. And there, that statement today is – or the statement now is more true than it was when it was written 4 or 5 years ago. We're going to be talking about concepts today that have been so revolutionary with respect to how trusts are created and administered that it really challenges, as I've said, traditional notions of ideas around trust planning that we've been used to. You know, when I was in law school, I really did not like trust and estates work, Tyler. I didn't enjoy the law school class at all. I thought it was boring and stale. But that's not the case anymore. It's an extremely dynamic environment. And it's changed so much in terms of what we're able to do in it. And when we focus specifically on the concept of the irrevocable trust, for example, I think you'll find that you'll quickly realize that what we can do with that irrevocable trust now is drastically different than what we were able to do 20 or 30 years ago. So as a lot of you know on this call, and a lot of you have actually heard me talk about in different venues, you know, what's happening around the world is, or rather around the country, is a race among various jurisdictions to become the most progressive jurisdiction, to capture trust business, frankly. And four states have emerged as the top-tier trust jurisdiction, particularly noted as by Trust and Estates magazine, law review articles, practitioners. They look at South Dakota, Delaware, Nevada, and Alaska as the leading trust jurisdictions. And they look at them as leading trust jurisdictions because they were the first and continue to be the most progressive relative to modern trust laws that have changed the industry so much, and it's what I was talking about earlier and what we're going to be talking about for the next hour or so. And so the question is, what really drives this comparison among the states? And really among the literature and among the experts, there are four or five main areas of sort of inquiry. And that is, does a state have a domestic asset protection statute? Does a state have a dynasty trust provision, which is to say that trusts can live forever? Does a state have taxation, which is an increasingly important topic and probably one of the most directly measurable aspects of the distinction between states? Really, trust planning now is become more of a state tax play in some interested in some instances rather than a federal tax play. Privacy laws and rules, which we'll talk about a little bit later, another modern development in particularly U.S. trust law. And then modern trust laws generally, which is where we're going to focus today. We're going to talk about modern trust laws that have radically changed the industry and really grew out of a direct response relative to what I think was perceived as a problem in the trust industry. And we'll talk about in that in more detail, but I think particularly control. There was a perception of lack of control, a lack of flexibility. And these modern trust laws directly address that. And what I love about it, Tyler, is that, you know, it's an industry response. When something's broken and the industry evolves to fix it, I think there's nothing really more satisfying. You see it in different industries, and the trust industry is no different. The trust approach, the traditional trust industry approach, the bundled approach, the big bank approach of putting together investment management and trust services and private banking, that whole approach became broken. And the wealthiest families in the country drove very powerful changes and said, look, I want more control. We need more flexibility. And states like South Dakota and Delaware and Nevada and Alaska, they heard that. And they created laws that changed the industry. And I think it's fascinating to have watched over the years.
Yeah, Dave, and as you talked about these states that are kind of revolutionizing the trust industry, and you just hit on it there, you know, there's this response from several of these states with these modern trust laws, with these other factors that go into trust and estate planning. Can you just touch on what is driving all of this change? You know, why are these states creating these new laws, you know, using all these different factors to, again, revolutionize the trust industry? Can you just touch on what is kind of behind this, behind the response, and what's been driving that change?
Well, I think you first saw it in 1983 when South Dakota became the first state in the country to abolish the rule against perpetuities, clearing the way for the dynasty trust that you see there. And I think they did that for a couple of reasons. One, to be responsive to the wealthiest of wealthy families in around the country and really the world, to create a vehicle to avoid estate tax forever over multiple multiple generations. But more particularly to your question, it also opened up a huge revenue source for the states like South Dakota and Delaware and Nevada and Alaska and the other sort of top-tier trust jurisdictions. I mean, the reality is a state like South Dakota, while people chuckle and say it's a flyover state, you know, it's become such a mecca for some of the most progressive trust rules and laws in the country. And that's not an accident. They want to be the best in the country because it drives a lot of revenue into that state. So they don't have a state income tax, so they have to find other ways for revenue. And you know, companies like Citibank have their headquarters in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Wells Fargo has their headquarters in South Dakota. Of course, Bridgeford Trust Company has its headquarters in South Dakota, a little bit smaller than those two yet, for now, but we're getting there. And the reality is it's just good business for these states. So that brings us to irrevocable trusts. You know, when I was in law school back in the 90s, the idea of irrevocable trusts were somewhat daunting. And what I mean by that is, you know, they were perceived to be, and in fact were, extremely inflexible. They were considered to be unchangeable, which is to say, you know, somebody's grandfather 60 years ago puts together a trust, and the idea was, well, that trust was going to live forever in some form or fashion, and we weren't going to be able to change it. And between the inflexibility and the lack of ability to change it, that would scare a lot of people away from using irrevocable trusts. Loss of control was another extremely probably troubling issue for lots of wealthy families, where they felt like when they made the trust and put the trust in place for estate planning reasons, for asset protection reasons, for dynasty sort of planning reasons, they would lose control. And most wealthy families, particularly first-generation business owners and wealth creators, they don't want to lose control, Tyler, and that's probably the biggest problem. But yet they have to give up some control, and they perceive they had to give up almost all control in order to achieve their estate planning objectives. And then when you talk about the problems with the traditional approach to irrevocable trusts, and you combine that with how the structure had evolved over the last 100 years, it was usually a traditional corporate trustee model based at a bank like Bank of New York Mellon or Wells Fargo or PNC, where they have a bank-based trust department that would act as a corporate trustee and also manage the money for people, which quite frankly are two very different disciplines and really unrelated disciplines. And so that evolved into another problem. So you have people's trepidation around the idea of using an irrevocable trust in the first place because of all the reasons I've already mentioned. And then when they do need a corporate trustee in an irrevocable situation, they were for years until the last 15 or 20 years sort of forced to go to a bank-based trust department that said, yeah, we'll be your trustee, but we also have to manage your money. Well, guess what? That's even a further loss of control, isn't it? And so that became unpalatable, for lack of a better word. But there was no other option. So you have organizations like Bank of New York Mellon, who are all great organizations, PNC, and they sort of amassed trillions of dollars of assets in trust, irrevocable trusts, and they were managed that money. And, you know, it's great business because 20 years ago, you couldn't change these trusts. You couldn't move these trusts. You couldn't get them out of some of these institutions very easily. And so that, again, added another layer of concern for wealthy families or for any family that needed or saw the value of some aspects of an irrevocable trust. And then you even add even more complexity. You know, the traditional corporate trustee approach carries with it some conflict of interest. I mean, unquestionably, there's conflict of interest with somebody being a trustee and managing your money. I mean, however we try to talk around it, you know, as a lawyer and then having worked at those large institutions, there is an inherent and I think unresolvable conflict of interest in many respects. I think there's also a big focus to cross-sell and really take these large families into areas and sell them products that maybe they don't necessarily need. And that's unfortunate. And that's another reason why they didn't like the corporate trustee model. Traditional corporate trustees, particularly under old notions of irrevocable trust, were extraordinarily rigid. It's very hard to get the money out when you wanted money. These administrative committees became very hard to deal with and very, very strict around whether or not beneficiaries were able to access money. And I used to see that firsthand. Not sure why. You know, I think it gets back to the conflict of interest issue. And then they're extraordinarily expensive. You know, I think that everybody on this call who's worked with a traditional corporate trustee, and those of you who are calling in that are with a corporate trustee, you know that the fee structure is pretty expensive. And so you combine all of these issues inherent with, first, irrevocable trusts, and then the traditional model for dealing with an irrevocable trust. What's developed was a problem. And the problem has been directly addressed by what we're going to call sort of a new paradigm here. And I think what the other offshoot here before we get into the solution, because I think we've pretty well identified the problem. But before we talk about the solution, we have to understand what was an unfortunate reality that began to develop. Because people were so unhappy with the traditional corporate trustee model, they would start to appoint Uncle Bob as their trustee. Or sometimes they'd appoint somebody even less remote to them. And so, or they'd want to appoint their attorney as their trustee, which that is not a bad choice intellectually, but that carries itself a conflict of interest. And in some states, particularly Pennsylvania, ethics committees have issued strong advisory opinions against the idea of appointing your attorney as your trustee. So now, well, not now, I think now that the situation's changed, but 10, 15 years ago, if somebody didn't want to go to a traditional corporate trustee and they wanted to have their own asset manager manage the money and have an individual trustee, their only options were, as I said, Uncle Bob. And as smart as Uncle Bob may be, he's not a professional fiduciary. He doesn't understand usually with the reporting requirements. And sadly, Uncle Bob will die someday. Unlike a trust company, they might be bought and sold, but they traditionally don't die. So again, we've outlined the problem, I think, in pretty stark detail. And we've also outlined the reason why we launched Bridgeford Trust Company, because we saw these problems in the industry. I saw them firsthand, both as a practicing attorney and then having been at large bank-based trust companies. And I realized that the ultra-high net worth landscape wanted more, needed more. And I did our research. We did a tremendous amount of research. And we realized that, in fact, there is a model and there is a vehicle to deliver relief from this kind of problem that I think we've identified pretty clearly. And we're excited to say that's how we built Bridgeford and that's how we settled on South Dakota.
So, Dave, I don't think it takes a trust and estate planning expert to see that you are not a big fan of the traditional model. So why don't you now jump into this new paradigm and talk about how it's delivering, you know, more control than ever before.
Absolutely. And Tyler, this is where it really gets exciting for me, and I think anybody who's sort of grown up in the trust industry, because virtually every concept I'm going to talk about was not available in the United States when I was in law school, and I graduated in the late 1998. And we talk about it as a paradigm shift, and sometimes that word paradigm is a bit overused, but in this instance, I think it's absolutely applicable. This paradigm shift, as I said, driven by an industry response to try to fix a broken system, a broken trustee system, has resulted in some extremely progressive trust laws that absolutely address the issues around irrevocable trusts and the issues inherent with respect to using a traditional corporate trustee that bundles together all these services. It brings control. It brings flexibility. It brings the fees down, these modern trust laws. And I absolutely believe, just as that quote that I read in the beginning says, these have all happened in the last 20 years. And that's what we're talking about, there being more change happening in the trust industry in the last 20 years, in the last two centuries. That is unequivocally true. And I think the first one and the most exciting one in my view, really, and it's the foundation for the entire conversation today, and that delivers the most control, is the idea of a directed trust. Now, this idea of a directed trust is actually something that's not unusual with respect to the rest of the world, but still relatively new in the United States. Although now it has been, I think, in place for 18 or 19 years or 20 years. And I believe South Dakota and Delaware were the first to come up with a directed trust model. The directed trust model directly addresses the issues around control with respect to particularly irrevocable trusts. Through bifurcating liability, and that's in red and underlined for a reason, this bifurcation of liability is the magic around and behind why these directed trusts work. Under South Dakota law, under Delaware law, there's only 8 or 9 states that have a directed trust statute. It's important to note, Tyler, that there is no directed trust statute in Pennsylvania. So if a Pennsylvania trust company is talking about doing a directed trust for somebody, that's misleading because you can't do directed trust in Pennsylvania or any other state that doesn't have a statute. I need to make that point because it's important. But this liability is bifurcating, meaning the investment manager and the investment management function and the trustee function is split apart legally. And an investment manager is only responsible for, from a fiduciary perspective, its activity as an investment manager, which is to say if they put everything into Enron or into a bank stock that crashes, that's what they're responsible for. The trustee's not responsible for that. And we'll explain why. The converse of that, if Bridgeford Trust Company makes an inappropriate distribution, or if Tyler, I give all of our money to you and you go to the Cayman Islands forever, asset manager is not responsible for that. So all of you on a call might be thinking on the webinar, well, why does that matter so much? That separation of liability clears the way for companies like Bridgeford to comfortably work with asset managers of the choosing of clients, beneficiaries, settlers, and other advisors. In other words, we are happy to work in an unbundled fashion with an asset manager that the family wants to work with. And because of the bifurcation liability, companies like Bridgeford are very happy to work with non-traditional assets, such as closely held stock, real estate, artwork, the kinds of things that traditional trust companies now don't want to do anymore. You know why, Tyler? Because traditional trust companies want to manage money. And that's where they're making their money. Some are good at it. Some aren't good at it. The point is it doesn't matter whether they're good at it or not. If somebody needs a corporate trustee, they shouldn't have to work with a trust company's trust department if they don't want to. So what we believe is that this idea of the directed trust has so drastically revolutionized the trust industry that it makes up for probably 98 or 99% of what it is that we do. So it places control back into the hands of the settlor. It places control back into the hands of the beneficiaries, and it puts control back into the hands of the advisors that are advising these folks by simply unbundling these traditional notions that have been bundled together because of the way the industry has evolved. And so by placing control back into the hands of these people, particularly the control around choosing the asset manager they want to work with, it has completely changed the industry in a way that makes an irrevocable trust not so scary, right, Tyler? So this is the first concept that we're saying that has changed an irrevocable trust. This directed trust structure directly speaks to several of the criticisms of a directed trust. Of an irrevocable trust. And when we go to the next slide, you'll see more specifically how that works. So here's the structure. Of course, we have John Doe Family Trust. Unlike a traditional trust, irrevocable trust, all of these functions, these three blocks, they're all combined under the power of, we'll say, Bank of New York Mellon and PNC. So the investment function happens at PNC, at the traditional bank department. distribution happens at the traditional bank department, and the administrative record keeping aspects of trust administration all happen in one place. As I've said several times, the directed trust model splits all these apart, and mechanically, here's how it works. Within the document itself, let's first focus, Tyler, on the investment committee. The investment committee is the committee where the power resides relative to investment management. People who can serve on that committee are the settlers of the trust themselves, which, again, let's talk about how much control that brings to the situation that wasn't there before. The settler can be on this committee. Really, anybody can be on this committee. The investment manager itself can be on this committee. The reality is, though, how this works mechanically is that the investment committee directs Bridgeford Trust Company to work with an investment manager that the investment committee has selected. They tell us who to work with. They don't ask us our permission. They tell us who to work with. So in the example here, John Doe Family Trust is established. Settler's on the trust committee, investment committee. Settler sends David Warren an email to Bridgeford and says, go hire John Smith's investment management to manage his money. Whether Bridgeford Trust Company likes that decision or not, we have to do it. So that's another aspect of control. We, that is Bridgeford or the traditional this trust company model that we work under, our only option is to resign if we don't like the direction we got. So the investment committee is in complete control of that. And that's very, very, very important. So that is a function that's been given back to the people, so to speak, and taken away from the traditional corporate trustee and has really changed, again, one of the most critical aspects of an irrevocable trust. Then there's the ability to create a distribution committee. So under the traditional model, as I've said, under the traditional approach of an irrevocable trust, there was a distribution committee that resided in the shadows of a trust company, and they made a decision. So if a beneficiary wants funding for college, or I guess more particularly wants funding for a new car, they have to go before the committee, make a request, and the committee decides whether or not that request is appropriate under the document, and I am here to tell you that I would finding more and more that administrative committees, trust administrative committees at those big banks were finding more and more ways not to grant these distribution requests. So in a direct response to that problem, which we'll call the problem of rigidity in the traditional model, the distribution committee can't be made up of the settler, but can be made up of family, other advisors like attorneys and accountants, and works the same way as the investment committee, Tyler. Johnny goes to the distribution committee and says, I want distribution to go buy myself a new Mercedes. Distribution committee looks at the document, says it's appropriate, and they say to Bridgeford, cut him a check for $500 or $50,000 to go buy that brand new Mercedes. The reality is the people on that, the distribution committee itself, is a fiduciary. So is the investment committee. So because we are receiving direction from a fiduciary inside the document, Bridgeford is exonerated, so to speak, which is where that bifurcation of liability happens. So we, as the administrative trustee, are essentially told what to do. And then when you go over by both the investment committee and distribution committee, and then you go over to the administrative trustee function, and there you see the administrative trustee performs its traditional functions as it would as a director trustee. But the pivotal point here, and I think one of the most compelling aspects of what we're doing here in modern trust law, is this simple structure gives and delivers back to attorneys, advisors, settlers, beneficiaries, future remainermen, infinitely more power over the investment capabilities and investment function and a distribution function, all within the framework of an irrevocable trust that up until this point was viewed as, again, inflexible, rigid, and hard to deal with. Tyler, from your perspective, is this clear?
Yeah, I would say this is pretty clear from someone who's certainly not an expert in this realm. And I think this is a great opportunity, Dave, just to hear maybe some of your experiences with some of the trusts that you guys have worked with at Bridgeford Trust Company. Do you see this structure? Is this already set up, or is this something that Bridgeford can help set up and kind of help, you know, family trusts understand the structure and get this structure in place?
It's a great question. Often we work with people around the country, Tyler, and increasingly now around the world who are not familiar with this structure. And so they come to Bridgeford through various avenues, typically through an investment advisor. And since we do not manage money, which is very important, and since we do not do insurance work, you know, we're very big collaborators in the marketplace. And so that collaboration allows us to step forward and say, hey, here's a structure here that delivers all the control that we're talking about, that we can employ here. So we help attorneys who aren't familiar with this structure by giving them template language that we've had generated for us from South Dakota Council. And usually, Tyler, where we see it is somebody comes to us and says, hey, I really need an asset protection trust, which we'll talk about later. And then we say, well, or they come to us and say, listen, I want my trust to be in South Dakota because there's no taxation, or I want my trust to be in South Dakota because the privacy laws are the best in the country. And then we say, well, do you realize that we can do this in a directed trust structure, delivering control back, and then we help them walk through it. Now, we don't practice law. I don't draft. Although I'm an attorney, as you know, I don't do any drafting. That would be inappropriate. So what we do is we give example language, and usually they work very closely with South Dakota Council that oversees the drafting of these trusts.
Perfect. I appreciate you taking the time just to go over that really quickly for any of our attendees today who, you know, might be interested in getting a structure like this set up. All right, so we talked about directed trusts, and now let's move on to the trust protector, also known as a super trustee.
Absolutely. So, Tyler, when we talk about control and we talk about flexibility, you know, the directed trust, as I've said several times, in my view, is the foundation and really the revolutionary aspect of what's different today compared to what was available 20 years ago. The trust protector is a sort of add-on to this. It's another extension and another sort of allocation of power within the traditional trust document. And it's very much a European concept, quite frankly. The idea of a trust protector, or they usually just call it a protector, has been something they've been doing for hundreds of years, and finally it's made their way in the United States. They've made their way in the United States. And essentially what a trust protector is, and as I've said, we call it a super trustee, is a fiduciary position separate from the trustee that has tremendous control over aspects of the trust. And in many respects, has more power than the administrative trustee, and that's why we call it a super trustee. So when you put the trustee, rather when you put the trust protector together with a directed trust, we've just amplified the control mechanisms and the flexibility aspects of this trust that you can never have had 20 years ago. And so the settlor usually wants somebody in there that he's close to, he or she is close to. It can be an accountant. Typically, it is a CPA. A settlor can put in there a good friend. The settlor can't make himself or herself the trust protector and shouldn't for conflict of interest reasons. But the reality is this person is, if you consider, like you look at the federal U.S. government or the U.S. governments and this idea around the constitutional check balance of powers and checks and balances, it's the same thing. So let's go to the next slide and we'll talk about what we can do. The trust protector has several powers. Probably the most compelling is the ability to easily replace the trustee with a signature. With a signature, the trust protector can replace the investment manager. With a signature, the trust protector, and this one's important, can change trust situs. In other words, can move a trust from one state jurisdiction to another. Trust protector has the power and ability to make distributions. The trust protector has the power and the ability to make investment decisions and investment direction. So I think it's clear that why now, I mean, it's clear now why we call it a trust, a super trustee. And so when we combine, again, this with the directed trust structure, we are delivering infinitely more control than was available 20 years ago. And so why would we even want this? Well, I've already talked about the reasons for control. And that's probably the most compelling aspect of it. I mean, we've talked about the reasons and the desire for families to have checks and balances over the process. And while there's the ability to do and put a trust protector in place, it's really important for me to make a quick distinction. Some states have a trust protector statute. Not all of them do. And we'll get to that later on in the presentation. But the reality is all of these laws are not created equally. among states, even among states that have directed trust statutes. They're not all created equally. And it's important to know that the trust protector statute, you need to look at carefully. Pennsylvania, shockingly enough, has one, but it's very limited. South Dakota, Delaware, Nevada, the other top-tier trust jurisdictions, of course, have them too. South Dakota has universally been referred to and acknowledged as being the most liberal, for lack of a better word. That's probably the wrong word, but let's say expansive. How's that? And that expansive list of powers you can have under the trust protector rules in South Dakota are powerful. But you don't need to use them all, Tyler. So often people say, well, I don't want to give that much power to somebody. And you don't have to. You can pick and choose which one of these powers that are enumerated under the law in South Dakota that you want to incorporate into the trust protector statute. And so, again, more flexibility, more control. And, you know, I've been talking about the flexibility and control with respect to administration of these trusts, right? Now I'm talking about flexibility and control even with respect to the creation of these irrevocable trusts. Again, very revolutionary concepts that are still slowly being accepted and, I think, implemented around the country. You and I have talked about this a lot. I'm often surprised how many people we meet, practitioners around the country who don't use directed trust, who are not familiar with trust protectors. And there's a real opportunity for some education here to get people to get their minds around what you can now do that you couldn't do 20 years ago.
Yeah, Dave, and we just had a question come in. The question is, can you initiate a trust protector within your trust even if you're not using the directed trust model? I know in your previous slide it says the trust protector is often used in conjunction with the directed trust. So is this something that you can be separated from that, or are they forced to be used together?
Tyler, that's an excellent question. They are not forced to be used together. We like to see them used together because it gives Bridgeford or companies like Bridgeford more specific direction. However, the specific answer to your question is no. There can just be a trust protector established, and that trust protector can have all of these powers that we've talked about and direct Bridgeford in much the same way as we talked about how Bridgeford is directed by the mechanisms of the directed trust statute. That's not ideal from our perspective, but the reality is you can still accomplish what we want to accomplish. Which leads us to something that is brand new, delivers a whole other aspect of control in the irrevocable trust space, is yet another reason why irrevocable trusts really, in my view, aren't really irrevocable anymore, at least under modern trust laws. And it's this idea of a family advisor. A lot of you on the webinar may never have heard of family advisor, primarily because it's brand new. South Dakota is the first state, as far as I know at this point, the only state to have carved out this special role in its trust laws. And it's been referred to as a trust protector light because essentially that's really what it is. It has some of the same powers as the trust protector. So that's important. Some of the same powers, limited powers. But what's most important about this role, Tyler, is it's a non-fiduciary role. So why does that matter, particularly the people, you know, listening in and you know, participating today? Because often trust protectors and even people serving on the administrative committees that we discussed in the director of trust, they're worried about their liability as a fiduciary because – you have liability as a fiduciary. And if a trust protector makes a bad decision, certainly that trust protector is going to be sued by somebody, whether a beneficiary or a future beneficiary or maybe a remainderman somewhere. So the reality is if I'm not in this industry and my buddy comes to me and says, hey, David, I want you to be trust protector and here's all the powers you're going to have, I don't know that I'd be all that excited about it. And so South Dakota acknowledged that. South Dakota has led the way in terms of giving more control back to beneficiaries and settlers and advisors, and created this position of trust protector, the trust protector light, family advisor. So on the next slide, we talk about sort of the powers that they do have. They can remove and appoint a trustee. They can appoint a successor trust protector. They can appoint a successor family advisor. They can appoint investment committee members. They can in more particularity, they can be and are allowed to be intimately involved and advise the trustee on particular matters with respect to trust administration and have the ability to receive information. So what I love about this position is everybody virtually that we talk to, Tyler, wants to dilute the control of the trust company and wants to dilute the negativity around an irrevocable trust. And so this is sort of on the spectrum of, well, you have directed trust, you have trust protector, but you may have a problem finding people to serve in that role because they're fiduciaries. And then South Dakota, I think, very intelligently created this role that is just carries with it less responsibility.
Dave, and I think it might be helpful if you could just kind of review what individuals would fill this role as a family advisor. I know for the trust protector, you mentioned, you know, that might be a CPA or someone of that nature. Are you looking at someone similar for this role, someone that just doesn't want to be a fiduciary, or might this be a family member? What have you seen from your experience?
Great question. And since it's so brand new, this is what we're seeing. Often, settlers of trust want their professionals to be trust protector. Okay, so like an investment advisor, for example, or an attorney and accountant. And often, attorneys and accountants and investment advisors will not be permitted to serve as trust protector because of the heightened fiduciary liability. So what we're seeing, in fact, is this law, and I think this is exactly what South Dakota was trying to do, was to open the door for settlers to use and appoint professionals who otherwise wouldn't be allowed by their compliance departments to serve as trust protector or otherwise were worried about the liability. So I think that your question is perfect, and I think that's exactly what we're seeing. And I think it's working the way it's supposed to be working.
And is this family advisor role, is that only available in South Dakota, or are there other trust jurisdictions out there that have this family advisor role?
As of right now, I'm not aware of any other jurisdiction that has carved out this family advisor role. And frankly, because of that, there's a lot of business that's being driven into South Dakota because of it.
Perfect. Great. I think that just helps some of our attendees on today's call and helps me understand the family advisor role a little bit better. All right. So with that, let's move into decanting.
So, Tyler, one of the aspects that we talked about that really people hated, for lack of a better word, about irrevocable trust is irrevocable sounds so final. And theoretically, I guess it is because it's a transfer into assets are put into a trust and you can't get them out. So what people have come to believe and what has been true for 150 years is that you really couldn't change the trust document or make meaningful changes to a trust document without going to court and spending thousands of dollars and having to prove why you needed to have these changes happen. Along comes decanting, and I think it's just as important and revolutionary as the trust protector and the directed trust in terms of the control aspects that are being delivered back to the families. Essentially what decanting is, much like a bottle of wine, you take an old, sort of tired trust that needs to be changed, or more importantly, a wealthy family wants to change, and you just pour it, and then when I say it, I'm talking about the assets, into a newly constructed trust with more desirable and flexible provisions. A new trust, perhaps, that you can put directed trust language in. A new trust where you can appoint a trust protector. A new trust where you can put privacy provisions in. A new trust where you can put asset protection provisions in. All of these modern trust laws that didn't exist when grandfather Ted drafted the trust 100 years ago. So through decanting, you can change these trusts. And you can make them modern, and you can make them more responsive, and through the process deliver so much more control back to the family, which again I think is very exciting. And you don't need court intervention to do this, which is very, very, very important. And it's a very powerful planning tool. So when do we see decanting being used? I think the most common use of it is to transfer trust situs to a more favorable trust jurisdiction like South Dakota. We'll come back to that. Correcting drafting errors, subdividing issues and distributions among beneficiaries, toggling, which doesn't say that on the slide, but that's a fancy way of saying switching a trust from a grantor trust to a non-grantor trust for tax purposes. As I've already mentioned, including asset protection provisions, changing the trustee, expanding trustee powers, creating the directed trust, all things I've already mentioned. These are just some of the reasons why we would want to do it. Going back to the first one. You know, one of the aspects of control that we're talking about, and something that is I'm extraordinarily passionate about, is when we come upon a trust that is when I say old and tired, I mean not modern and doesn't have the provisions that we think it should have in there, or hasn't been able to avail itself of the modern trust laws, and frankly is in a jurisdiction that is old and tired, like Pennsylvania or other, or New Jersey or California, that just don't have the ability to do this type of flexible planning and progressive planning. Decanting is the magic weapon. It's sort of the, you know, we heard on the news the last couple of days, the nuclear option, right? The Congress exercised the nuclear option. This is the nuclear option. You know, companies that have that say that they have all these irrevocable trusts that are unmovable and that can't be changed, and therefore the beneficiaries are stuck with the big traditional bank trust departments and they can't move away from some of these organizations because of the irrevocable nature. This is the weapon and the tool against that. We can easily now move these trusts away from a poorly performing trust company and create, or rather recreate, these trusts in the image of the modern trust laws, giving the power to the settlors or the beneficiaries to work with the investment managers they want, to work with distribution committees they want to, and it breathes all new life into these trusts. And this is a very, very popular concept. It's being used more and more every day. We use it. We're involved with it weekly in terms of moving trusts when people come to us. And interestingly enough, there are several states that have the decanting statute. New York was the first to have it. The most important thing to think about, though, is they're not all created equally, these statutes, and I need to make that distinction very important. There's a chart that we'll go to next that talks about comparing these decanting statutes. And again, not all these states have – I mean, although they may have decanting statutes, they're not all the same. South Dakota has consistently over the years been ranked as having the most flexible and the most powerful decanting statute. And it's interesting to compare that to that of Delaware. You know, Delaware seems to have been traditionally been considered the progressive trust jurisdiction, particularly on the East Coast. And I think you'll find more and more Delaware has not and has slipped a bit. I guess slipped is the wrong word. Hasn't kept up. States like South Dakota, Nevada, and others have become much more nimble. And so as you look at these two charts – it's the same chart. It just rates them all. South Dakota has been considered the top. And it's important when you're getting ready to do this. It isn't just going to a jurisdiction that has better trust laws than Pennsylvania or New York, New Jersey, wherever. It's also – now we have the ability to figure out really which one's the best one to go to. And in my view, if we know which one's the best, we should probably use it.
Dave, you called the decanting the magic weapon. And again, from someone who's not – an expert in this industry, it seems like there's a big money-saving opportunity here where you could transfer your trust from, as you called it, you know, an older, tired trust in a state with less favorable trust jurisdiction statutes to a modern trust jurisdiction with a lot of these modern trust laws that we're talking about now. So is that one of the ways that you've seen decanting use, as someone who, as trustees are looking to make significant money-saving decisions?
Absolutely. And that's an excellent observation. Moving a trust from a jurisdiction like Pennsylvania that taxes resident trusts, taxes the undistributed income, for example, at a little over 3%. If we decant that trust into a South Dakota trust or a Delaware trust in a ordinary state that doesn't have state income tax, we've absolutely, absolutely saved that trust money. And that's probably something I should have said first. In addition to all the modern trust laws we can apply, there's absolutely a tax move here. And it's a tax move, frankly, that's been supported by case law in Pennsylvania, particularly the McNeil case, where it supports the idea that trusts are not to be taxed at the undistributed income level. But that's an excellent question. So as we move into modern – as we continue to talk about modern trust laws and how they have absolutely changed traditional notions of how we approach irrevocable trusts, how we approach trust planning generally, you know, there's another aspect of this that is extremely important, and it's privacy. South Dakota, other states have some privacy provisions, but it's another one of these modern trust laws that we go over quickly here that lends itself to the argument I've made that the trust industry is so different today and that there's so much more that we can do that we couldn't do before. And what you'll see is in South Dakota particularly, it has been universally considered, particularly by Trust in the States magazine, as having the most powerful privacy provisions in the country. So powerful as such is that it's been referred to as the Little Switzerland, which I'm not sure we like that, but it's been called the Little Switzerland. And, you know, we're very aggressive in South Dakota to say, you know, there is a difference between privacy and secrecy. And in South Dakota, we're not inviting people to come there if they're looking to keep things secret. But privacy, we're all entitled to. And that's what South Dakota has built its walls around. There's the ability to have a quiet trust provision in all of these trusts, which means that there's no disclosure requirement to children when they turn 18 and they're in college and they're the beneficiary of a $25 million trust. They're not compelled anymore to tell that child who's 18 that he has availability to all those funds. Wealthy families really like that, Tyler. Again, control, right? We're talking about control. We're talking about flexibility. And we're talking about changing the trust industry. This is a modern trust law that has taken a old rule and changed it dramatically. In the old days, and I guess I shouldn't say that, in most states, in fact, still today, there is a mandatory requirement to notify the trust, the beneficiary when they turn 18 that they're the beneficiary of a trust. I could tell you I've been in multiple meetings around the country and even now around the world where that's really upsetting. And in fact, often the settlers of trust don't even know that's in place. So then one day they get a call from Johnny and he's like, well, Dad, I like my Lamborghini now. And what are you talking about? Well, he's got a statement from Wells Fargo and apparently I have access to a $25 million trust. So I that is a huge issue and one that we're pretty happy about being able to avoid under South Dakota law. So we're going to quickly transition into what is really the last modern trust law that I want to talk about today that I think sort of helps me make the final argument that we began with, that irrevocable trusts really just aren't irrevocable anymore in the notions that we thought they were, and that the trust industry is just radically different. This idea of a domestic asset protection trust is powerful, and it has been a direct industry response. Again, I talk about how fascinating it is to watch the industry evolve. And this is an evolution and a direct response to assets that were moved offshore to places like the Cook's Island or Bahamas or Nevis for asset protection purposes. And so many years ago, within the last 20, 25 years, states like South Dakota, Delaware created the modern trust law of a domestic asset protection trust. And it fits very nicely into the whole new paradigm that I've talked about because it also delivers control while providing asset protection. These trusts, it's important to understand, are self-settled trusts. That means that, Tyler, you can settle this trust and fund a trust with $20 million. And still have access to income and still be able to have discretionary distributions as long as they're consistent with the document and still maintain control over how the assets are managed, how the assets are distributed, and who manages the assets, who the trustee is, all the control mechanisms that I've already talked about. Because not only is it a self-directed domestic asset protection trust, but we would recommend that it's also a directed trust with a trust protector provision, or maybe we put in the family advisor, and we add privacy provisions to this. And when you combine all of these modern trust laws with respect to the domestic asset protection trust all into one document, which you can do very, very easily, what you have is a very powerful vehicle that you still have control over, but you're able to enjoy domestic asset protection. And I, again, become very excited and passionate about all of these different factors coming together, which, again, comes back to the question, well, gosh, you know, these irrevocable trusts, it really doesn't even look the same anymore, does it? So, you know, each state has their own asset protection. I'm sorry, not all states have asset protection trusts. It's very important to make a distinction among states, which one is the best. It's easy to determine that. Trust in the States magazine has consistently said South Dakota, Nevada, Alaska, and Delaware have the top asset protection statutes in the country, which is great. I think even between and among those states, there's a distinction, and that's important to understand. In the context of domestic asset protection trust, really the most important question we all should be concerned about, particularly lawyers who are drafting these, is what's the look-back period on these? And when I say look-back, the fancy legal term is fraudulent conveyance. And in Delaware, for example, it's 4 years. which means that when you create the trust, put assets into it, you have to wait 4 years to enjoy the protection that you would get from an asset protection trust. In South Dakota, it's 2 years. That's an important distinction and something that I think drives a lot of asset protection trusts into South Dakota. And it sort of helps us springboard into the next couple of topics because, you know, all of these modern trust laws, Tyler, as exciting as they are and as amazing as they are that have changed the jurisdiction, I mean, that have changed the conversation, what makes it so interesting is they're not all created equally. So just because now we've gone through and you and I have talked about and identified, wow, these are great and you have more control and wow, we really, this irrevocable concept isn't quite so scary and we can work around it and wow, look at all the flexibility we have. But then we have to get a little more specific and say, well, look, just because a state has some of these laws and just because a state has been determined to be a top tier trust jurisdiction, that doesn't end the inquiry, in our opinion. And that was the inquiry that Bridgford engaged in, Tyler, 5-6 years ago when we went to launch a trust company. And the reality is these states, even the top-tier trust states, are not created equally. We are young enough to say with credibility we chose deliberately to be in South Dakota for a particular reason. We made a decision based on information created by people far smarter than myself and my partners. And we found objectively that when you actually objectively compare some of these states, there are aspects about South Dakota that elevates it, in our view, a little bit above the other top tier trust jurisdictions. Is that to say, Tyler, the other trust jurisdictions are bad? Absolutely not. I'm saying, why not go to the best option if it's there? And if it doesn't cost you any more to do that, why not do it? And so just very quickly, this chart goes through and it makes a comparison. We mentioned Dynasty Trust that was established in 1983, and South Dakota was the first to do it. Steve Oceans, a Nevada attorney, creates charts, and he created the canting chart that we just looked at. He's determined that South Dakota is the most powerful dynasty trust state. South Dakota is one of the only states that has a community property state, a community property trust, rather. It has a domestic asset protection, as we talked about, has trust protector. The directed trust statute's been acknowledged as being one of the best in the country and actually, frankly, copied around the country by other states, particularly Florida. The canting, I've already told you, that's been considered to be the best, the canting statute in the country. Trust provisions, as I've already mentioned, is considered to be the most powerful in South Dakota. And the direct quote from Trust in the States magazine says, of the top-tier trust jurisdiction, South Dakota has the best trust privacy laws. Again, people, that's not Bridgford saying that. That's not David Warren's opinion. These are people who have been looking at these issues for years and years. An idea called a special purpose entity, which we did not talk about much today. South Dakota is the only one in the country that has a special purpose entity codified by statute. That's a very powerful protection mechanism to use for these advisors that we discussed. And finally, the family advisor. So when you look at these issues in the aggregate, when we talk about the theme or thesis of our conversation today, which is, well, irrevocable trusts aren't really irrevocable anymore. I believe that. I think we've shown why irrevocability of a trust is not the same. I think we've clearly demonstrated the revolutionary aspects of what's occurred in the trust industry and how we can just simply deliver much more control and flexibility to the trust planning process than we ever could before. But that's only half the conversation or part of the conversation. The other conversation is then where do you go to avail yourself of these modern trust laws? And I think this chart makes that point.
And Dave, before you wrap up here with today's presentation, we do have a few questions that have come in. So I think this is a good time to touch on one of them while we have all of these modern trust laws on the screen here. And that is, have any of these statutes or modern trust laws been overturned or found to not work?
No, in fact, I think that the most controversial perhaps of all these maybe would be controversial is the wrong word. Debatable is the domestic asset protection statute. There are some practitioners that challenge whether or not these actually are going to be upheld. But as we sit here today, there's not a single instance where a domestic asset protection statute itself has been shot down, for lack of a better phrase. And I think that from that perspective, we believe that's a powerful tool. I believe that in instances where the asset protection statutes have been challenged, it's because they were fraudulent conveyance. They were used in a nefarious way, but never the statute themselves has ever been knocked down. So the way I like to sort of end, and I think we do have a couple more questions, but this is another quote from Trust in the States magazine that I think is particularly timely. and frankly was one of the guiding principles for the establishment of Bridgeford and I believe probably other trust companies like ours. And the trust industry is undergoing a quiet revolution that has wrested control of trust accounts away from traditional corporate trustees, primarily the big banks and other large institutions, and put it back into the hands of settlers of trusts, beneficiaries, and their advisors. I think that quote from Trust in the States magazine in 2012 is, again, more true today than even when it was written 5 or 6 years ago. The industry is different. The traditional model has been broken for a while, and the industry response is utterly fascinating. And to be able to be positioned to deliver the control that we've been talking about for the last hour and to be able to deal in a modern trust world and a modern trust era with clients, particularly wealthy clients, is extraordinarily satisfying and dynamic and exciting.
And the trust industry might be going, undergoing a quiet revolution. But Dave, I know this is not something that it's easy to keep you quiet about. This is something you're really passionate about. And even just listening to you today, you know, this is something, you know, you get loud about, you like to talk about. And again, you're just very passionate about talking about these modern trust laws. So we're going to go over a few of the questions that have come in. I think we have enough time for that. And while we do that, we're just going to put some additional information about Bridgeford Trust on the screen. And you can see Dave's contact information there. So if we're not able to get to any of the questions that you submitted today, please feel free to reach out to Dave, send him an email, give him a call. He'd be happy to talk with you and go over any of these modern trust laws that we've gone over today. So Dave, first question that has come in is about the international space. And I know that Bridgeford's done some work in the international space. So I feel like this ties in pretty well with you and what you've done with Bridgeford. And that's, how do these modern trust laws work in the international trust space?
They work very well. As we've talked about in a past webinar, and as you'll see in the very near future, coming from Bridgeford and the writing and videos that we will be producing, there are a myriad of reasons why people are coming to the United States. Wealthy families are coming to the United States, and it isn't just a trickle effect. It's an overwhelming wave of families that are coming from Latin America, from Europe. And again, I won't tell you all the reasons here today. These modern trust laws I've talked about are extraordinarily attractive to the international community. And they're attractive to the international community for the same reasons why they're attractive to the domestic community. The idea of being able to have far more control over the administration and creation of these trusts is something that is brought a lot of enthusiasm. They were, in many cases, in fact, yesterday I was on a call with an attorney who's bringing a very, very large Italian family to the United States, and he had no idea of these control mechanisms. And he was sort of blown away by it. And this is sort of how much education is needed out there. And so the question is very timely, not only because we're able to answer a direct need in the international community, but it's where Bridgeford is focusing a lot of its energy. And so more to come on that, Tyler. I know we're going to do a webinar soon on that. We have some blog posts that we're going to be producing talking about, you know, foreign trusts, hybrid trusts, how to move trusts from various aspects – various areas of the world into the United States and particularly South Dakota.
Great. That's perfect, Dave. So again, we're running a little bit low on time, so I'm going to ask these final two questions together. You can answer them and then just feel free to wrap up the webinar after that, Dave. So the first question is it difficult to change trust jurisdiction? And maybe you can touch on whether you're changing from state to state or international to domestic. And then finally is, how will these modern trust laws impact fees? And I'm assuming they're talking about trust service fees.
Yep. No, they're great. They actually are tied together. First of all, no, it's not hard to move these trusts. Many states, including Pennsylvania, have specific statutes or rules around it. You don't have to go to court to move these trusts in most of these states, and it's relatively inexpensive. I think there's really a misconception in the advisor community, probably promulgated by trust companies, that you can't move these trusts very easily without going to court, and that's not true. And I think, as we talked about decanting and all these other new modern trust laws, that makes it a lot easier. In international space, it's the same conversation. Often, we're doing a decant of a trust. Again, you don't need to go to court to do that. Particularly when all the beneficiaries are signing off on it, because usually everybody wants this to happen. Everybody wants this to happen except the incumbent trust company. And frankly, at this point, they really can't do much to stop it. Even the case law isn't in their favor. I mean, to remove a trust company now, you don't even have to show cause in most states, which is a dramatic departure, which gives more control back to the families that we're talking about. All of this impacts fees in a very positive way. I mentioned in the beginning of the webinar, one of the complaints, and I will tell you, Tyler, one of the primary complaints is around fees, or has been around fees for these traditional trust companies. Because of the bundled approach, the fees would be very expensive, and you didn't know really what you were paying for, because there was asset management and there was trust administration. And as I've said, they're different disciplines and different functions. So people just sort of accepted a large bundled fee and figured that was industry appropriate. Well, when you break apart these functions, or as I like to say, unbundle them, the fee becomes really a lot more transparent, and you're able to delineate which and for what you're paying for and why. And so the directed trust model drives the trust fee down, frankly, because if we're paying attention to the details, the traditional trust company has a lot less responsibility and liability. So a company like Bridgeford is able to combine well with an asset manager, and typically the fees are 15-20% less than what you'd see in an industry comparison relative to the traditional bundled approach. And our clients really like that. Clearly, it has a big impact, and I'm proud of that, quite frankly. So, Tyler, listen, it's been great. I always appreciate the opportunity to collaborate with you on these webinars. We're extremely excited, as I've said over and over again, about what we're now able to do because of these modern trust laws. We're excited to be able to work through Bridgeford and particularly out of South Dakota to deliver what we think are some of the most powerful planning capabilities, not only in the United States but around the world. Please feel free to contact us or contact me directly if you have any questions. There is a lot of information on the website, a lot of white papers, a lot of videos, and a lot of what we are told is extremely useful information. Bridgeford will be speaking a lot over the next 6 months around the country, particularly in Florida and on the West Coast, on international issues. Watch for those details, and hopefully we can see some of our friends from around the world and the country there. And Tyler, again, I always appreciate the opportunity to talk with you, and thank you very much.